Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Rolling with Bags, Dykes, and Jacks. I'm Tom Howley, Andrew on the board. Second day in a row. We have S&P futures down a little bit. Down 575, NASDAQ futures down 75. We had a rally yesterday for the first time in 3 days. We had the S&P was up 35, NASDAQ up 118. So for 3 down days, we had a rally. So today maybe sneaking the other way. All they did was tout how the interest rates were pausing and going down, but they ended up yesterday up a little bit, or at least unchanged. So that didn't really work out. So kind of unchanged again today. So that's kind of where we're at. We have Professor Liu.
Good morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
Good. Tough day to be a San Diego Clippers fan, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what you got. I want you to explain that to me. I have a first question, though, just on a general population.
Sorry, San Diego Clippers, LA yeah, Clippers.
LA Clippers, yep. I went to my chiropractor yesterday, right? Terrific guy. Matter of fact, he used to do some work for the NFL, I think, when he was young. One of these guys basically works his ass off all day. He says to me, this is a society question, Lewis, I don't know if you're ready for it. We always talk on the show about how many people now, despite what, you know, the buffoonish administration and every administration before them, focuses on this unemployment rate, which is a totally made-up number, when in fact you should be looking at the participation rate and how many
participation
people.
Participation rate, yeah.
Yeah, he says to me, Tom, you know stuff, and when somebody says that, you know you got to brace yourself, right? He says, I took a look at this. Everybody's talking about this court case where this lady killed her kids.
Yeah, the Clancy case in Massachusetts.
Yes, he goes, I just took a look just so I, you know, wasn't a total idiot. He goes, I can't believe the amount of people that are commenting on this and arguing back and forth. He goes, what's that all about? Doesn't anybody have a job? You know, why would anybody feel that they have any idea what's going on? They're not in the jury box. I look at him and I go, your lips to God's ear, bud. Louis, you know, I'm very strong.
Have you followed that?
A little bit, but I'm saying I have very strong opinions about stuff I know something about, which would be, you know, the monetary theory and options and maybe some baseball because I played softball for 40 years. Other than that, I have never once questioned a jury or a court because I'm not there. That's the whole point, is they have 12 people that are there. Well, how does everybody else get these opinions and all of a sudden know everything all about it?
So this case, I've been following it mainly because of the facts are horrific. It's sensational. This woman who was on this cocktail of drugs because she was suffering from something called postpartum depression. She had 3 kids, including the newborn. She very calculatingly sends her husband out to get pick up food for dinner from a place that she Google Maps to see how long it's going to take him. And then while he is on the road, she calls him and asks him to pick up something else at a drugstore so that it delays his return. While he's out driving, she takes these exercise bands and wraps them around the necks of her children, strangles them one by one, and then throws herself out of the second floor window, breaking her neck and paralyzing herself from the waist down. She also tried to cut herself. She's a nurse. So sensational facts. apparently, because of the publicity and so first of all, you have a whole bunch of true crime podcasts that latch onto this case because it's sensational, and so they latch onto the case, and you know, now you've got all kinds of commentators, lawyers, former prosecutors coming in and talking about the state of the evidence and what's proved. Apparently, there is no, or that the defense has admitted that she performed, that she murdered the kids. There's no question about that. So their defense is mental capacity, based on a number of factors, the postpartum.
Okay, now when you say defense, she's still not getting out. It's a question of whether she's going to jail or to a sanitarium, basically.
No. If the jury doesn't convict her on either count or on either charge, she goes free.
That's not what they said in the air here. They said in the air here, even if she's not guilty, she's going to spend the rest of her life in a mental institution.
Only if they convict her of actually committing the crime.
Okay, I thought she was in no matter what. Just a question of where. See, that's how I'm wrong on this.
No, I mean, we got right now, they're looking at a hung jury, which can't means that there's no conviction. Now, I assume she's being held in some kind of pretrial confinement, but. So a couple of weird things have happened. You got all these people commenting on it, so that inflames the interest. There is apparently a huge movement of women with children who are coming to her defense and saying, you can't find her guilty. She's postpartum depression is real. I've wanted to kill my kids a couple of times. I mean,
but you haven't. There's the difference.
There's a huge difference. Yeah. I mean, in my opinion.
Wanting to poke somebody is not the same as poking them.
That's right. So this has hit in a bunch of different ways. The commentators are, you know, people like Megyn Kelly and some other folks that do this true crime stuff are all over this because they're just saying these women are crazy. These women that are supporting her are sick. It's clear she murdered them. She admits that. It's also irrespective of whether we throw her in jail or we throw her in a mental institution, she needs to be confined and taken off the streets.
I would kind of roll with that, even though I promised not to give my opinion. I thought that was her choice where she was in.
Yeah, that's the rational choice. But you know, they could find her not guilty of any of this. Her husband has taken her side, apparently, publicly. I don't know how that works. That poor guy.
Somebody's killed your kids and you're okay with it?
Comes home, yeah. That poor guy comes home. His wife is out in the front yard with a broken neck, unconscious. He goes inside and finds the bodies of his three children who have been strangled to death. Not a good day. There's a lot of weird stuff playing in, and it's all, you know, if we're going to stereotype and generalize, it's all emotion, and we know who specializes in emotions and feelings, and you know, pushes those up to the front as a basis for making a decision or taking a position, and so that's what seems to be happening.
Well, since you know much more than this, I don't know. I think you don't really have a chance to listen to shows on other days, but we have my buddy Dr. Mark Johnson, Dr. Blade, is a psychologist, and he's been a psychologist forever. But the thing that got me onto this is my chiropractor says to me yesterday, you know, he goes, you know, even in chiropractic, we had to take a course or two in a lot of these drugs people are taking now in case you came across it with a patient. Mm-hmm. And he said, a lot of these drugs are being handed out to people, and they're not, he goes, we learned this years ago. He said, they're being handed out to people, and they're not being monitored very well, and if you double up or you mess up on your prescription, they're really, really dangerous. He goes, so I don't know what cocktails she was taking and whether she was anywhere near. It's the same thing Dr. Blade has said a million times. He goes, if you have, I'm just going to paraphrase what he said because I'm not the expert. He says, if you have this certain chemical imbalance which causes somebody to be, different, what do they call it, the different mood things.
Schizophrenic.
No, that's, you know, what's the one that everybody seems to have now?
Bipolar
or something. He goes, If you're that person, he goes, these drugs are absolutely the silver bullet. They are a miracle. He said, but if you're not, and if somebody doesn't monitor you before and after, which he says nobody wants to do now, they just want to give you the prescription. He goes, if you're not monitored back and forth, if it's not you, it has totally different changes to your mentality. And that's why it could make you super high. That's why the kids that actually need it, or supposedly need it, the other kids in school are always stealing it from them. Because for them, it's like a big high. He goes, but the problem is the industry now just wants to pass them out, and nobody really wants to schedule everybody for an hour session for the next 5 months to see if it's working right, or else pull a kid off it, or person. He's a follow-up. Is everybody just wants everybody in school on these drugs if they even have... I mean, how many guys did you know when you were in grammar school had kind of ants in their pants, but they were, there was nothing wrong with them. They just were a little restless. They were just
they
being
were
guys.
Boys.
Yeah, they were just being guys. And the nuns knew how to take care of it. They'd say, okay, walk around the room twice and go back and sit out or something. They didn't, you know, it was no big deal. I mean, for some kids maybe it was. He says, but this is Dr. Blader, and my chiropractor, he goes, a lot of people have these drugs that shouldn't have them. And it was if some is good, more isn't necessarily better. He goes, I don't, he goes, the idea of murdering somebody, but if she was totally unabashed with about four of those drug things in front of him, he goes, who knows what she could have done to her mind?
Yeah, so this
how does
is
that
one
fit
the,
in? I mean, so I'm asking you, how does that fit
this
in?
This is one of the issues. I mean, having listened to a couple of commentators, psychiatric practitioners who talked about this, they all say the same thing, which is the way that she was administered medication, and there was no primary care provider that was overseeing this. She was going to emergency
back
room
up a
physicians.
Second. In this world, how many people you know actually have a primary care provider or a quarterback? I'll call them. I'm going to say 20% of the people.
I don't know. I do.
I do mean, too. But I mean, you hear people going into hospitals. They talk to 15 different people. And they walk out, and I say, "Who's your doctor?" I don't know. I guess all of them. Eh.
I mean, I've got a bunch of people that I've talked to for various things over the years, but it all funnels through. When I go in for my annual checkup, my primary care guy or my contact, and this is our my health insurance sets this up this way. My contact sees everything.
This is becoming rarer and rarer. Consider yourself lucky.
In any event. She did not have a primary care provider, and there was no reason that she shouldn't have. She couldn't have one. She's a frickin' nurse, for example. So she's getting prescribed this cocktail of medications, and they're just slapping them on her one after another, and she was deteriorating mentally. That was obvious to her husband and her family. All of this goes to the issue of whether she was sane or not, but. But the overriding thing here is, you know, typically in an insanity defense case, it's whether the defendant has the mental capacity to understand that what they're doing is wrong. And so we have all this stuff that's going on with her in terms of her depression, in terms of her being afraid of her thoughts and all this. And yet, at the same time, we have an absolutely calculated, cold-blooded plan to murder the children. And she knew she did it. She was following. She says she was following voices, which conveniently only happened when she murdered the kids. But it told her to kill them and take her own life.
Which she didn't do a very good job at.
Well, right. So the question is. We get it. Whatever normal breaks are functioning on somebody's psyche, we're not functioning for her. But
well, how bad is she after falling out of the window? Is she a mess now?
Yeah, she's a paraplegic.
Oh,
paralyzed from the waist down.
Well, that's good lord.
So the question is, could she appreciate the fact that what she was doing was wrong? And there's every indication that she knew what she was doing was wrong, that she knew her husband would have prevented her from doing it, and that this was something that she felt she needed to do.
Well, if you let her go, he's going to take care of her. She's in a wheelchair.
I don't know. presumably her husband, you know, who said she was ill, not evil. But this is the fight. So the jury right now is basically hung because they can't figure out what there's a split over whether she was sane or not. As I said, the issues here. Can we feel sorry for her? Can we say, hey, she shouldn't have been given all these drugs? Can we say that's the explanation for what happened? Of course. But at the end of the day, the issue is, was she capable of appreciating that what she was doing was wrong and knew it was wrong and planned to do it anyway?
Wow.
So it's an awful case. I don't. There are no winners.
No. Why does everybody feel like they got to fly in a comet and be part of it? I mean, I'm just curious because of the drug angle and how, you know, it's just part of our kind of ongoing theme of how much money the medical establishment is costing us, and are they doing any good for people? I mean, in all cases, I'm sure they aren't a lot of cases, but I mean, I see people here. Lou, and it's a different subject. A couple of them I think you might have met where they've gone to Northwestern, been there for 7 days, and walk out, and they got all these, they couldn't name a guy that's their doctor. You know, and you can't even name what they did to you when you're in there and stuff. I mean, it's bizarre.
I think her health situation was mismanaged, at least based on the, as I said, the practitioners that I've listened to. But you know, this comes down. So let me give you another example, and this also involves.
I also want you to talk about Bomber, because this is a pretty. I can't see this happening to the Knicks. Is that a horrible thing for me to say?
Yeah, it is, but probably right. There's a case in Utah involving a guy who cold bloodedly stabbed I think like an 8 month old to death. It was his nephew, I believe, one of the children of his brother, and he cold bloodedly came into the house and killed the child, and admitted it, you know, and did it because God had told him, and he was a practitioner of this bizarre Mormon sect offshoot that you know, the Mormon Church, like every other major religious denomination, has certain extreme edges, and this was one.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
But he believed that God had, and I mean, he literally testified at his trial when he's looking down at this baby. He's got this fishing knife.
We got Catholics who think we're all heathens because we got rid of the Latin Mass. So
I know.
Yeah.
But he looks down at the baby and testifies at trial that he tells the baby, I don't know why you have to die, but God is saying this is part of the plan. And then cold-bloodedly stabs the baby to death. First-degree murder, life imprisonment. And given that it was Utah, I don't understand why they didn't execute him. But the point is, this is a sort of a comparable situation. Obviously insane. Obviously by our standards, crazy. But did he have an appreciation that what he was doing was wrong? I think he did. I'm not, you know, and whether you know, he was hearing a voice telling him to do it or not, he understood that he shouldn't be killing the baby, because he said to himself, I don't understand why you have to die, because I understand that it's wrong, but, you know, here we go.
Well, I don't really care whether this lady's, now that she is in a wheelchair, but if she wasn't, you let her out, we're either let her have a couple more kids. I mean, that would not be too clever.
Well, and so you, I mean, there are all kinds of interesting angles on this. I mean, one of the angles that's going on right now is you've got thousands, and I mean thousands and thousands of women who have, excuse me, who have latched onto this, saying she's innocent. We all have had postpartum depression. It's a real thing. You know, we can't hold her accountable. Da, 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 which of course then leads to a counter argument of people saying, so this is why we should never have given you all the vote. You know, because if your feelings like this or whatever, if your hormones are a defense to murdering three of your children, then what are the implications for everyday life with you all? You know,
there's a fine line here, Lou, and you're touching on it. Everybody, I think, has issues, right? And I never had a baby, but if somebody tells me they have postpartum depression, I'm going to believe it. They're not lying to me. I mean, it's a question. This is just another, I don't know, you want to call it a test of life. I don't know why the hell we're all here in the first place, but it's sort of like, you know, I won't say sort of like because I never, but, you know, guys have a midlife crisis. Okay, join the club. The health club, go buy the sports car, get over it.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
but,
you know, but, you know, the thing I think is missing, Lou, honestly, and I'll lob one at you from my own personal experience, is we're missing, and I don't know how you put this together, but the world is sort of different than when I grew up and when you grew up. I mean, I'll give you an example. I don't know if my mother wanted to kill me. I wouldn't have blamed her if she did. Evidently, I was very colicky. And this is before you had a bunch of different kinds of formula. And evidently, I just had a problem with cow's milk. And I don't know if she could have handled it on her own, but within 3 miles was my grandmother and two of her sisters that would constantly spell her and come over and walk me up and down the street, and I'd cry at them for a while. And one day, my grandmother found somebody that I guess said, you got to put the kid on goat's milk. And as soon as they did, I guess I was okay. I just had a problem with cow's milk. And I don't know what would have happened if she and my dad were living out in the country somewhere and didn't have her sisters and her mother and people for that kind of support. I mean, I don't know. You know, I hope she wouldn't have killed me. but the thought might have been there. I'm not making this funny at all. I'm saying we're sort of missing this support. I mean, like I said, I don't want to talk about women, but if you are going to have, and I know people have to go places for work and you meet people and you go places, but if you're going to have a family, it might not be the smartest thing on earth to move away from your two or three sisters and your mother that you're very close to. Because guess what? You need help.
Yeah, you do. And this, so you touched on an interesting point, because when you said being far away from family, we had both of our kids in a military environment. Obviously, hundreds, in some cases, thousands and thousands of miles away from family. And what you saw, I don't know if I appreciated it quite as much then, but I do now. And what you saw was these informal networks of moms, of wives, mostly, because most of the people I was serving with were men. But this informal network of spouses and wives that would spring up to help, and they were there. It was really interesting to watch. There were all kinds of support play. When we had our first child, we were in a base in New Mexico, and you know, my parents were, my father was still coaching, and my mother was still had. Interacting with my other three siblings, and it was really something to watch this thing swing into effect. I mean there were women I'd never seen in my life over at our house, you know, swinging by, dropping stuff off. There was a network of people to talk to who said, listen, here's how this works. There were when we would go to parties, there would be the moms would be in one area, and they would be sharing stories, they would be sharing advice. It was really kind of dramatic. And you know, our modern, I don't know if that still happens.
It can happen. And my grandmother, actually, she had six kids, and evidently I know nothing about this, Lou, but she never had any problem breastfeeding the kids. And it was, you know, because some people have an issue, obviously. And a lot of times, there would be a lady on the block, you know, that would have problems, and everybody knew everybody. And if they weren't sure their kid was getting enough, my grandmother used to breastfeed them. other people's kids. I mean, if somebody was having an issue with the lady next door, I mean, they swung into action and took care of each other. You know, and it, I mean, you had to do that stuff. You had no air conditioning. You had no, I mean, in one of the guys, my buddies had like a heart issue downstairs in the bar where he was for a while in the intensive care at Northwestern. And they've got a beautiful intensive care there where the significant other can actually stay there and they have a shower for them and everything else. Where her pack of friends every night brought food, brought her clean clothes, did her laundry. She was stayed there for like 2 weeks. What do you do if you don't have that? I mean, I guess you survive somehow, but what? Just the everyday stuff is so hard to do if you have no help when you have a crisis.
Yeah, and you know, the old line was when you have a baby, your IQ drops like 30 points because it's almost impossible. Or young children, it's impossible to have a coherent string of thoughts because you only get about 30 seconds to do that at the most. And usually less.
You need a break. You need a break.
There's always something intruding. There's always something cutting it off. And yeah, anyway, this Clancy case is turning into a microcosm of social commentary that.
But
that,
why Lou, does why? I mean, this
these,
is
with,
a.
With, well, hold on, with women coming on, this thousands of women coming forward and saying, "Yeah, we can't be held responsible because of our hormones," and at the same time, the justice system looking around going, you know, are we really going to have a jury that's going to say we can't convict this woman because we can't figure out exactly what was wrong with her? But we know she killed her kids, but we can't figure out what to do with her.
Well, there needs to be a fallback spot where even if she's, quote, not guilty within a reasonable doubt, you can't go let her have a family again. I mean, I don't know what the fallback position is, but I mean, you can't. I thought that the difference was whether she was in jail or in a sanitarium. I didn't realize that she'd be out.
I mean, that's. I'm giving you all the possibilities.
Okay.
Do I think that she is going to be released? No. And I think if there's a mistrial, that the state will try her again, and will put her back on trial again and conduct the trial. I suspect what will happen is there'll be a plea deal offered, which is almost unthinkable to me. But
that's what somebody on the radio yesterday happened to be driving around the car. You know, the thing that bothers living bejesus me, and I always make the connection, Lou. And I mean, you have a talent and a fault, and every subject you drive it back to the law, which is what you do. Every time we have a subject here, I drive it back to money.
And economics,
And I go back, okay, how much did she pay for this crap, or did somebody pay for it? Who prescribed it? Who didn't watch her? Did the person who prescribed it even come see her again?
We'll see, and this is where it's going to get interesting from a lawyer perspective, because you raise the question. Once we get past this criminal trial, the lawsuit, if I'm the dad, and maybe her, but if I'm the dad, the lawsuit against the medical community for mismanaging her medications is going to be significant.
I think if you, I don't know if he'd say it, I don't want to put words in his mouth, even though I'd known the guy for 50 years. I would say Dr. Blade would say that anybody who prescribes something that strong for somebody and doesn't do a follow-up at least twice in the next month probably should be. I should let him on before he says that, but I'll bet he's pretty close to saying that.
Again, I don't know the nature of her medical.
I don't either. I'm just saying in general,
health insurance system.
You're giving out strong stuff.
But I guarantee you, and I will tell you right now, based on the way that my practitioners operate, if I was getting prescribed a, if I was, so the, what she had, as I understand it, were a series of emergency room visits where they prescribed medication. If I was going in for that, the second time I went in for an emergency room visit, that doctor would have on a screen the fact that I had been prescribed medication previously, and an artificial intelligence assessment like WebMD or something like that of the interactions with those medications, and they
something
would
that
said,
every pharmacist should know anyway.
Well, if every pharmacist should know that exactly, yeah. Right. But the prescribing doctor would be seeing a run of this, and after the second or third time, that physician should have been seeing this and saying, wait a minute, we're just throwing drugs at you.
Yeah.
Let's slow down here and try to figure out some way to get an intervention with this woman. I mean we have a huge network, a net of social workers, psychiatric social workers, people who specialize in depression. I mean, they could have routed her to some agency that would have helped her try to provide childcare. Well,
my concern, Lou, is that big money is preventing that.
But there's no reason to prevent. Well, there's no,
sure,
there's no
there is. Money's
incentive.
Always a reason.
There's no economic incentive, but I don't see the economic incentive to.
What do you think these pills cost? I have no idea. I bet they're not cheap.
I don't see the economic incentive to this. This is dangerous, and it would have. I mean, the economic incentive would have been exactly the opposite. It would have been, wait a minute, what are we prescribing here? Who's giving her this stuff? And what are the interactions that we need to worry about? One of the heartbreaking aspects of this case, and as I said, there are no winners. It is tragic. But she was talking to her husband. She was talking to her mother. She was talking to again to these medical providers, saying, "I'm losing it. I'm breaking down." I mean, she was watching herself deteriorate and knowing that she was deteriorating in real time.
Well,
and it's awful. I mean, now apparently there is some testimony that she either told her mother or her husband that she was afraid she might harm the children. And I don't understand why at that point there was not a major move by somebody in her family. I promise you, if my wife had said, you know, I'm really depressed and I'm afraid I'm gonna hurt the children, she would have been out of the house in 2 seconds. I would have said, you need to go stay with your mom. You need to get out of here. I'll hire somebody to come in and watch the children. But you're not going to stay around.
Yeah, that's
if you're thinking that. And I don't know why that didn't trigger an emergency response, fight or flight response in the people who heard it.
All right, what do you say we switch to the LSU versus SEC and Ballmer?
Well, let's talk about Ballmer first. So
right, set the tone. The headline. Let me read the headline. The owner. Now, how the hell you suspend? NBA suspends Clippers owner Ballmer for 1 year and Kawhi Leonard salary cap probe. How do you suspend the owner? But that's your question. But
well,
so you know this. They're the loss of five first round picks.
Yeah,
that means they never challenged the Knicks or the Celtics. What?
Let's set the stage. So Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers, the LA Clippers, set up a way to circumvent the NBA's salary cap.
And Leonard's a known carpetbagger kind of guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he's that good a basketball player. I mean, he's good.
But he seems to be the swing person that every team wants him, and then once they get him, they can't wait to get rid of him.
Can't wait to get rid of him. So they set up, they do exactly what we used to talk about being done in college. They set up phony deals with a variety of companies who allegedly provided compensation to him without any required work performance. Now, the issue was
okay,
that these companies...
Okay, back up a second. When Jordan, to this day, made all that money with Nike, he never had to do anything, did he, other than put his name on the shoe?
Yeah, he authorized his name.
I know, but... I'm saying, how is that different from
the trick.
Okay.
These companies weren't paying Leonard. Ballmer was. They set up a phony arrangement, and then Ballmer said, look, you know, you're gonna have a contract with him. And they set up a couple of phony companies to do this as well. But
why didn't they just pay him like Jordan? It's a lot easier, right?
Yeah. You're gonna have a contract with him, but I'm gonna give you the money to pay him.
Ah.
And you just pay him, and so
because nobody wants his name on a shoe, so he had to pay Nike to pay him.
Yes.
Oh God.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, it was quote unquote endorsements, but they were phony endorsements. In any event, this was clear. I mean, the money was coming from the club. Clear intent to violate the salary cap so that they could pay this kid more.
And he's not worth more to start with, but that's another story.
Yeah. The leagues will put up with a lot of stuff, a lot of misconduct. They'll put up with a lot of things from the players and from the owners. They'll put up with you hooking up with $140 an hour prostitutes in a trailer park in suburban Ohio. But when you go and play games with the salary cap, when you circumvent it, and just flat out violate it.
The team wasn't even any good.
That's right.
What's the difference?
That, when you do that, that cuts to the integrity of the game, and it cuts to the bit. And this goes back to your point about money, Tom. You know, listen, I can put up with a lot of stuff. You can beat your girlfriend. You can crash cars. You can drive drunk. But when you go to my checkbook and you start affecting my, you know, you're playing games with money, I'm drawing the line. And that's basically what happened here. So the league just went, I mean, they nuked him. $30 million, I think it was a $30 million fine, and then 5 first-round draft picks stripped. I don't think I've ever heard of anything like
first
that.
First of all, why would you penalize if the fans, so all those, the team's going to be, why should the team be crap for 10 years? Make them sell it or do something.
I mean, that's, you know, that's their problem. You know, the league says, look, I got to fix this.
If they did that to Boston, they'd be assassinated.
I got to fix this owner. And we got to fix him. So we're going to nuke them. I agree with you. If it was a big market, you know, if it was one of the big market teams, if it was the, you know, if it was the Lakers or the Knicks, who are the champions right now, you don't see this.
You're not going to get the 5 first round pick penalty. That's
probably
sure.
not. Probably not. But that is a. This is we're going to make an example out of these guys.
Nobody wants the Clippers to win.
Yeah, the Clippers, they were the team that was involved in that owner making the horrible race comments, right?
Somehow Ballmer got
that
in, yeah.
That they got rid of him?
I don't know, where's Matt Weber?
They forced him out about 10 years ago?
Yeah, that's how Ballmer got in, I think.
Right.
Well, but
so
I
anyway, so this is a nuclear weapon dropped on top of this club. And
but when these guys all of a sudden decide to get moral, it just makes me laugh.
Well, but that's what I mean. I mean it's the, you know, we'll put up with all kinds of stuff. You can bring guns into the locker room and, you know, do all kinds of things, and we'll slap your wrist. But when you go to undermine our ability to pay our players,
who cares? The one year, who was the guy? Your buddy, it wasn't your buddy, but you know what I'm talking about. Remember when Matt Millen was the general manager of the Lions?
Yes.
Well, the Lions were basically horse bleep, right? And one year, I'm reading this stuff because I was going to talk to you and I'm supposed to know something. I was talking about, this is before the season starts, where I guess you can be over the salary cap as long as you get it down by the time the last cuts are made.
Correct.
Well, the team that was the highest over the salary cap by far was the Lions, and they had won like 8 games in the last 3 years or something. Good Lord. But he had how many wide receivers was the guy paying massive amounts, and he didn't have a quarterback and he didn't have a line? Finally, they just traded half the guys and got under the salary cap, and I'm going, why would anybody care if this idiot's paying more than he's paying the dog walker, for God's sake.
Because you don't want to enable guys, you know, it's bad enough to be corrupt, but to be corrupt and ineffective is
well, yeah,
you know, the real sin. Well, the reason you jump on these guys and try to make an example out of these guys is you don't want really competent people like Belichick or Stan Kroenke getting a hold of the idea that they can do this, because if they do it, then it's going to make a big difference. By the way, did you see that story about how the New England Patriots were affecting field goal kicking in their home stadium? They have the Patriots have the greatest differential between, during the Belichick years, have the greatest differential between made kicks by the Patriots and made kicks by the visiting teams of any team in the NFL, and it's a huge, it's
even
a huge
even like spread. A Soldier Field where it's so windy and stuff.
Yeah, but if it's windy, that affects both clubs. What the Patriots were doing is they were putting up a view up on their giant jumbotron, at which are at each end of the stadium. They were putting up a giant jumbotron view of the field goal from the rear. So as the kicker lines up to kick the field goal, he looks at the goalpost, but right behind him is another set of goalposts, because he's looking at, you know, he's looking at the jumbotron, which is projecting him and the kick. And so it, the theory is that this was giving visual, you know, acuity issues, because you were looking, you know, your perception was off, and they were doing this consistently, and it apparent. I mean, the allegation is it made a huge difference.
I love it. I mean, what it's
so as I said, you don't want cheating to get into the world of somebody who really knows how to cheat and really knows how to do it effectively.
What about the Knicks all those years that would lower the air in the ball?
I don't know about the Knicks, but...
They did it with Bill Bradley and those guys. They didn't have a big center, so they somehow found a way to stick the needle in the ball during the game and lower it by a couple of pounds.
That's funny. I hadn't heard that story.
Yeah, the Knicks did everything they possibly could, but when Bill Bradley became a senator, he was the orchestrator of a lot of this stuff. The Knicks were incredible at that kind of thing.
I mean, Belichick and the Patriots did all kinds of shenanigans. So yeah, that's a thing, and they're gonna make an example out of these guys. You know, they didn't just suspend Ballmer. They took a number of high ranking executives. The you know, team.
I don't see how you can give a team that essentially has a fan base, that kind of a thing. I don't see how you do that.
Like I said, if it had been a team with more, with more clout, maybe not.
But I can't imagine them giving the Lakers 5 years without a number one pick. I can't imagine that.
Yeah, it you know. And suspended.
Look at the problems the Lakers are giving everybody with the ownership.
Right. Well, yeah. Now that's a separate fight with, you know, with the, who is it, Genie Buss?
Yeah. The whole idea. You know my views on salary cap, but we don't have much time. I want to talk about this. I have conversations with everybody, Louis, and the only thing I can conclude, is not that I'm right, but that I'm old. I'm not old in a bad way, but I actually believe. I mean, when was the Sherman Act? 1930 or something? It was a while ago. It was long before me.
It was late 1800s.
Okay, well, what was the one? Was the Clayton Act was 19 something?
Clayton was later. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and in fact, I was discussing this with my my nephew, and you know, and he's a regular kid, and he works hard, and he's like, he says to me, I said, you know, this thing with the pros not going back, he said, well, they shouldn't be able to. And I go, okay, well, who makes that determination? If somebody goes somewhere else and tries to get a job at another business, can't get it, can he come back to somebody in the old business? Well, I don't think they should. And I like, well, you know, this is being an uncle. I said, well, who the hell are you, Matahari? I mean, you don't get, you and I don't get to make these rules. The rules are there. We get to change them if we want to, but we're talking about, and I trust, we're talking about somebody deciding that in every business, everybody wants their business, has special reasons why their business should not be competitive, right? I mean, everybody has that. That's just the way people are. But the rules are there saying, no, everybody has to be competitive. No, we don't pay attention to those rules anymore. But somebody, I don't see how one professional league that somehow seems to think they're not a professional league whenever they don't want to be, but whenever they do want to be, they are. How they get to make the split here. The split is obvious. If you're going to be in a professional league, you are a professional league. And if you're going to pay somebody a bunch of money, he's a pro, even if you think he isn't. I mean, what? Why am I so clear on this, in my mind anyway, and everybody else?
Let me follow up on your discussion yesterday, because I did listen to your discussion with Kevin and who else was
Eric,
up there?
John,
Eric. Well, welcome back, Eric, by the way.
Oh, Eric's terrific, yeah.
And I've said this, the model that everybody is jumping on with these college players and trying to force them into an employment model is wrong. You need to rethink the way we look at these kids. These college players.
When you say
that they are not employees.
They aren't now, but they.
They're not, and they never were, and they never should be. They're not employees. This is a situation in something called in loco parentis, where you have the coaches and the university people are effectively acting as these kids' parents. And if you doubt that, look at the rules that are imposed on college players that would in no way be legal or tolerated in a workforce or in a work environment. The work environment, the work analogy, employee analogy is a terrible one. It's just not a fit. And that's why one of the reasons why you're getting all this craziness coming out of the SEC and the NCAA in terms of how they're trying to manage these kids. If you look at them as basically people for whom you are exercising a kind of parental authority, then this all gets a lot easier. We don't have to worry about overtime. We can pay them. We can still give them money. They're just not wages, you know. It might be income, but it's not wages, and we can characterize this as and with a lot more flexibility in terms of how we manage these systems. But if you think these kids are employees, you literally are trying to force a square peg into a round hole.
Well, I think the question is, let me make it a sidecar thing. Suppose you and I, Lou, decide to run a series of a couple of cooking schools, and the kids come in there and we teach them how to cook, and one day we say, you know, in order for them to really learn how to cook, we should probably open up a cafeteria or something, and all of a sudden everybody come in and buy chow for, you know, half
this,
the price.
This, by the way, is done at the University of Houston and the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
I get it. I think they do it here too. But all of a sudden we say, you know, we're making some pretty good chow. How about we go get a lease on the river and send these kids in there to cook there, where now we're charging $100 for a steak. And we're going to essentially compete with the other guys, but guess what? We get to pay our guys a hell of a lot less. So finally our guys go, hey, wait a minute, what about me? I'm actually working 8 hours in this place. I'm working as hard as the chef next door. You got to pay me something. Well, somewhere along the line you start paying the person. You still think he's a student, but at some point, you have entered the professional arena, which the colleges are doing. My point is, they can't. I mean, if it was the Notre Dame in my era, when Dave Casper sat next to me in the economics class and they played 9 games, and I don't even know if they played. Well, they played a bowl game when I was there. Before I was there, they didn't. Lou, I'm with you 100%. But they've decided to take it to the next level. They've decided. When every kid you see on TV is in his fourth college, you can't tell me that anybody gives a crap about a local parentis on this kid. They don't care. I mean, he may be going to class. The graduate students, do they even have to go to class? I mean, probably not. I mean, they've taken it to the... I'm with you 100% up until 20 years ago.
That's my point. The reason you're seeing the kind of blow-ups we're seeing right now is because we're trying to manage these kids as if they were employees. And I think that's the wrong model.
Well, what are they?
Pardon me?
I mean, Notre Dame is now going to go play Sunday night national TV against the University of Wisconsin. That never happened when I was in school. Nobody played on a Labor Day weekend. We didn't even in school yet, for God's sake. I mean, I'm saying that they have taken it, just like the restaurant. The restaurant firm has decided to go compete with Gibson's, but with people in the kitchen that are still allegedly students. Well, at some point, the kids didn't decide to do that. You did. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I understand. And my point is, if you look at it, if we come in and say, okay, we've got you know, these huge money making opportunities. All right, fine. We'll set up a mechanism that says, as long as you're enrolled and taking classes here, you're a student, which gives us a lot more flexibility in terms of control of you, for example. I mean, what would be the restaurant analogy is pretty good, but it ends, and it's 6 o'clock now. The restaurant analogy is not quite complete because the control that you would exercise over the chefs.
I just thought it up.
I know. It's a good analogy. But the control that you exercise over those chefs is not nearly the control that you would exercise
over a college athlete. When you catch some kid in his. They can't even give an interview and he's in his fourth school in his fourth year, how much control you have over his education to start with.
Well, and that's I agree. And that's part of the thing. If you look at these guys as employees, you don't care about that stuff.
Well, if you were to ask the kid, what do you do in college? What's he going to do? I take English or I play football?
That's a good question.
I'm going to say he plays football.
Okay. We'll leave it at that. I see Andrew and
as
Wayne
usual,
coming
in. Really, really good stuff. What is with that flood in the Grand Canyon? Holy crap!
If you want to read something horrible, look up the story of the fact that there are 46 Nepalese hydro engineers trapped in a tunnel in that awful collapse and landslide, mudslide that came down that river valley. They've been there for a week, and they think they're still alive, and they're trying to dig them
out.
Well,
how did another time? I see the part about, you know, I've been watching all this stuff because I'm curious. I mean, obviously, I'm curious enough to have all you knowledgeable guys on the show that I can pick brains of. I don't understand how if a whole hunk of glacier falls off in the ocean, it takes like a month to melt. How did this thing fall off and like an hour later is all of a sudden this surging water running down the place?
Well, it came down with, first of all, there was a lot of water in the glacier when it collapsed.
Oh, okay. All
so
right, right.
It released a lot of water along with the ice. And then second of all, it's coming down, you know, it's going through a river valley. It just pushes all that water and everything else with it.
Oh, so it basically was like a dam break and it pushed the water down.
Exactly.
All right. Because otherwise I'm like, how did this all melt all of a sudden?
Yeah, it didn't instantaneously melt. It was ice, dirt, boulders. They think about 2 million tons of debris.
Did you see pictures of these? You know, when I hope I don't want to slap you upside the head because first of all you'd slap me back. But the picture of these people in the Grand Canyon, these little canyons they're walking through, where if you get like a quarter inch of rain, the thing becomes a torrent of water. What is with these people?
I don't know, but you know, we lose track of how dangerous nature is in this culture. We have people killed out here. I think there's 10 people right now could be killed by lightning in El Paso County here just because they weren't paying attention. You forget about how dangerous it is.
All right, buddy. Have a nice weekend.
You too.
Are you stay weekending or are you traveling?
We're staying.
All right. Have a nice time. SP Futures.
Go Air Force football.
Yeah. SP Futures flat. Nancy Futures down 60. Do we have our guys?
Yeah, well, you have me. And
how are you, bud?
I just want to let you know that today the Trump dollar coin goes into circulation. So check your pocket change.
what did we do with Susan B. Anthony?
Susan who?
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I mean,
how do we bounce her off the buck?
Well, this is a good morning.
How are you?
First, this is a commemorative coin because it's illegal to make currency with a living president. So the top lawyers in the administration have nothing better to do than find a workaround, and so this is a commemorative coin. That has apparent value. In fact, it's being sold at multiple price of what the denomination is, so that the
can you short them?
Yes.
and yet the U.S. Mint just made an announcement that the coin will be in general circulation. So they found a workaround. You dudes would never guess.
But guess what I have at home.
What's that?
I have a roll of Susan B. Anthony dollars. Are those any good anymore?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You might ask yourself, why, Chief? Are you such a moron to have a roll of Susan?
I wonder what happened to the Eisenhower dollar coins.
You know what?
They were a thing.
I had so many of those. When I used to go to Vegas in the 70s, In the slot machines, you actually use regular dollars. And you could use regular regular dollars at the blackjack table. But if you had 20 of them and wanted to take them home, you needed, like, suspenders and a belt. They weighed a ton. You couldn't put them in your pocket. But so I don't know. All those are gone. If you go to Vegas now, they're all fake coins. They're made by... But the Susan B. Anthony, the reason why I got a roll is that when they put in the new parking meters here, the only cash that they would accept were dollar coins. But then I got the app, because Maddie Weber said, don't ever put your credit card in the damn thing, because it'll read it or something.
Right.
So, but I never used them. So sitting on my dresser is a roll, like it's 20 of the... Are they even worth a buck anymore, or where do we toss her?
Oh, sure. They retain their value.
Unbelievable. But, you know, he has people that will find unbelievable laws to allow him to do stuff he shouldn't, but then we'll find laws that nobody's ever used to allow him to do other stuff, right? You know,
the Artful Dodger.
Yeah, it's a...
Well, that's the purpose of legal education, is to justify what the client wants, right?
Well, I mean, how does somebody even go back through... Andrew, this is a question for you. Why don't we ever kick any of these laws out of there? I mean, Trump found an 1890 law allowing him to do tariffs. Where the hell's that law been for 130 years? Why doesn't anybody strike it from the books?
Well, if I were in the next room, I could pull down a copy of a book written by a Notre Dame graduate who was not only one of my closest friends, but he was a hell of a guy, a hell of a writer and a reporter, an attorney, and he wrote a book called Legal Lunacy with his wife. His name was Tom Condon. He graduated from Notre Dame about 1967, went into the Army for Vietnam. But the point of my anecdote here is he collected all these laws still on the books. Let me see if I can remember at least two of them. In Lexington, Kentucky, it's illegal to be on the street with an ice cream cone in your pocket.
And it may be kind of foolish, but why is it illegal?
Well, you'd have to go to the legislative history. I was
just had an ice cream cone in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
I think he used that joke, the old Mae West, Cary Grant line. But it's a very amusing book, and it's all kinds of crazy stuff that some idiot in the legislature got passed in various times and places. They never took off the books. Now, here's a more serious one. You were talking about the Mormon Church, or LDS. They had a quite contentious history in Missouri before they came to Illinois that I once researched. And there was some question about one of the adherents of the faith shooting the governor who lived. And the gist of it is, in the 1830s, they passed a law that if you wanted to take the property of a Mormon, you could do it legally. And you are a non-Mormon. And that law somehow stayed on the books until the 1950s. It wasn't enforced, and I'm not sure that people tried to use it after the church became more respectable, but that's an example of...
Better not let Trump find it.
Yeah. whose job is it, really, to go through the statute books and find laws that don't make any sense?
Well, Andrew, you might be the one to either knock this permanently from my brain, or can tell me maybe I'm actually right. I seem to recall when I was like in high school and college, people talking about some sort of a, I don't know if I've asked you this before, that when you pass a law, be it a tax law, be it whatever it is, that they would have an automatic review, a mandatory review, 6 months, a year, 18 months afterward, that they would actually put in the bill and say, we got to make sure this is working as intended. So we we were going to bring it back up again, and whether you do anything about it or not, I guess, but it at least was a call to take a look at this one, because it's big enough to where we want to make sure that, you know, it's an infrastructure program that actually it's helping anybody, or if it's a tax program, is it doing what it's supposed to? Is that totally by the boards, or was I, am I an idiot for even thinking that it was there ever there?
No, I think some legislatures have tried to do it, but, you know, there are competing demands for time. Increasingly, it's to attend fundraisers. And, you know, how are you going to get really ahead in your political life if instead of going to fundraisers to raise money, you're doing, you know, kind of detailed work like that that's not really recognized by the media, the voters, and so forth.
Well, whatever we're doing now, we got ourselves in the corner pretty good.
Well, yeah. By the way, I was able, as you were framing the question, to walk 10 feet and pull out my copy of this book, Legal Lunacy, Unbelievable but True Laws, Past and Present. Here's one. It's illegal for flying saucers to land in the vineyards of France.
God.
So in Vermont, it's illegal to paint a horse. Here's one you'll like. A bill in Maine called for a legal hunting season on attorneys. And the back cover is illustrated with the Mae West joke that you and Wayne mentioned, because in big letters it says, is that an ice cream cone in your pocket? If it is, you're under arrest. Except in Kentucky.
God. But, you know, these people have, like, sort of nothing better to do. I don't know if you guys have been following this Chicago politics, but my question is, I mean, I'm just talking about procedure, man. You know, whatever, who wins is not a, I cast my one vote and that's it. But we in Illinois, and in Andrews from Illinois, Evergreen Park and Oak Lawn, where you were hatched, always have had, you never ran as a Democrat or Republican. You ran, and you had to change the party's name every election. So you always ran as allegedly non-affiliated, but of course everybody kind of knew who you were affiliated with. And then one year you'd have the better government party, and the next year to be the good government party, or you know, that kind of thing, and they keep switching off. Well, now, Chicago used to have the normal Democrat-Republican thing, where you'd have a primary on each side. Well, now, it's an every man for himself. If you get enough signatures, you're on there. And we're reaching at some level, and I like your guys' opinion on this, the two top vote-getters, unless you get a majority, which nobody's going to get, then run in a runoff election, which, you know, tends to be, I'll use the term, real election. But the other part is when you get so many people like Lori Lightfoot, like her or don't like her, was the top vote-getter in the first election, in the primary or whatever, the general, anybody gets to be on there. I think she had 90,000 votes, okay, in a city of pushing 3 million. We're not 3 million anymore, but say 2.7. We used to be over 3 million. Now, it's not a hell of a lot of people, guys. And now the mayor is going to throw his hat in the ring next week. And I was with a couple of older attorneys last night, and they're like, he doesn't have a chance of winning. I go, guys, he doesn't have a chance probably of winning the runoff, or if there was a mayoral election. But you can't tell me that if, well, you can. I mean, obviously free to disagree, and I could be wrong. You can't tell me that if there's like 11 people on the ballot, which I think we're up to, 11 or 12, where the top vote-getters are probably going to be like 70 and 60, that the incumbent mayor can't come up with 60,000 votes, for God's sake, even if it's all teachers' union. And they say, well, the teachers' union is pissed at him. He didn't give him enough. But he gave him more than anybody else. I mean, I don't see how. I mean, I said, you know, I don't like the guy at all. But to think that he can't come up with 60,000 votes, we're getting to the point now where if one of us ran and our family voted for us, we'd be in the top two, for God's sake, because there's so many people there. How does this, to me, this is kind of denigrating sort of everything. I mean, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I think you're, with the jungle primary, it's what you're referring to, and I think California may have been the pioneer in that. They're taking another look at that. They may get rid of their, you know, jungle primary, or everybody's in it, and, you know, the top two are go into the runoff if they don't get over 50%. And the reason California is looking at that is they had, I think it was the governor's race, they ran the risk of two Republicans topping the candidates. And they said, oh, no, this is too close for comfort. And so they're seriously considering scrapping it. And if California does it, I think you may see that system disappear in the other states.
Well, I mean, it's down to, do you really want somebody being mayor? Would, you know, I'm gonna use, I don't know how the thing is in New York, but, you know, theoretically, this guy Willie Wilson, he's a decent enough guy. He's an African American guy, made a lot of money, and he gives gasoline away to people. Okay, well, if you get 50 people in the primary, I'm not saying he wouldn't be a decent mayor. I don't even know the guy; he could very well be, but he could have 30,000 people he gave gas to and voted for him, and you know, and all of a sudden, you know, I mean, at some point, are you really representative of a 3 million person place? I mean,
no. And there's a larger pattern that I think points the way to the solution if we identify the pattern, which is that people don't like the current system, and this could go back generations or whatever, so they come up with a reform, and the reform sounds good, and then it's enacted, and then the connivers, the operatives, the big money or whatever, they figure out a way to pervert the reform. And let me give maybe two quick examples. So in the old days, it would be like the old original Richard Daley, the mayor, who would, for the most part, get together and pick presidential candidates. And then they started having primaries, and it was fairly few states that actually had them when Kennedy, JFK ran and brought his charisma and won. And then people started saying, hey, we like this, let's have primaries and everything. And let's get rid of the polls and the parties that are the smoke-filled rooms. Well, the smoke-filled rooms, in part, their function was to pick viable candidates. I mean, there's a dark side to it. But people thought, let's let the people decide and vote. But then, to get to the point here, people said, well, to have primaries, you got to have campaign money and all this financing, which brings a whole set of problems that you've identified, and every reform brings its own problem. Now, here's, I think, a reform that has a lot to offer, which is ranked choice voting, like they have in Alaska and a few other places. And I think...
All right, explain to everybody, you got to explain to everybody what ranked choice voting is.
Oh, so you... Let's say in a primary, you vote for who you want. Say there's 15 people, like you were saying. But then you vote for who you... If that person doesn't get it, who's your second and third choice? And so you take the group of 17 candidates, and if it's a close election, you narrow it down. And if you have reasonably informed voters, ultimately you're going to get a much better approximation of who's really popular than if you just vote for one of the 17 candidates. Now, I'm sure there's ways to corrupt that system, but I don't think they've been figured out yet on a mass scale. But as Wayne was saying, just have a primary, come one, come all. Every year in new presidential year in New Hampshire, you have, what's his name? Vermin, Extreme Vermin is a candidate. What's the guy's name?
Oh, the guy that wears a boot on his head, Vernon Supreme.
Yeah, Vermin.
Vermin Supreme, right.
Yeah, like a rat. And yeah. So this guy gets his ego done by running every 4 years up in New Hampshire.
Is he like Lard Daly or worse?
Well, I don't think he's necessarily a bad guy, but...
Well, neither was Lard Daly. I thought he was a really good guy. Remember him? Lard America First Daly, running for mayor and everything every year?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, we see a lot of them in Washington, various people who are everywhere because their ego demands it. And I'm not talking about elected people. I'm just talking... there's a guy... it was at the courthouse and outside the White House, and he calls himself the street conductor, and he's got nothing better to do than
is forgetting to tell you that one of those candidates was myself when I ran for press club president as a insurgent.
Did you get a sandwich sent?
I was the Vermin Supreme for
a while. No, you weren't, Wayne. You were a legitimate candidate. You regrettably lost through suspected machinations in the vote counting. But Wayne was running on an actual platform. But at any rate, there's a larger pattern of people want to reform the system, but the connivers figure out a way to pervert it.
Taking a look at this Chicago thing, and I know we're probably talking about it too much, but it's really a money. There's a lot of money involved in being mayor of the city, for God's sake. But the people who are running, it's kind of an interesting combination of virtually every political heavyweight that's around, and some of them have their other job. And one lady, well, Mike Quigley's running. But he's going to run for rep in November. So if he loses for mayor and whatever the hell that is, February, it really doesn't matter. He's running. Maria Pappas is running. Andrew Licaro, I think she's the Cook County Treasurer. She's something. But she's a big name. Alexei Janulius is the Secretary of State. Now, he's still going to be the Secretary of State if he loses. I think he's not resigning. There's Mendoza lady, who's the Comptroller of the Currency. Now, she's actually resigned to run for this. And then... God, who the hell else? There's Willie Wilson running. There's got to be like three other people that are all real people. I mean, it's not like they don't have a spot or they're the three of us putting our name in there. These people that have gotten serious votes in statewide or certainly an area wide election. Some of which have their own job, so I won't say it's a lark. But Mendoza has actually quit her job. Which is interesting. Alexei's got more money than anybody. I don't know where he got all that Greek money, but he did. And he's been on, if you kick on YouTube, Alexei's got a commercial on there.
He's a good friend of Obama.
Well, they play basketball. Yeah, they play basketball together.
Right.
Alexei, right? Well, I know him a little bit. When I say a little bit, a very little bit, because John's wife years ago. I mean, she just retired as a judge. This is when she was running. That's how long ago this was. Alexei was he'd run for he was something else before he was treasurer. He was treasurer. Now he's a secretary of state, which by the way is probably the biggest job in the state in terms of how many people work for you. Matter of fact, it has to be other than maybe the governor. But he I meet him at this fundraiser. Now he came. He got out of school. He must have gone to some small college and played basketball or something. So I'm talking to him. He's a tall kid, nice enough. And he goes, I said, so when you got out of college, what'd you do? Well, that's easy. I went and played basketball in Europe. And I go, well, that's kind of cool. I wish I could have done that, but it's not exactly a resume. I didn't say that. But and then what? Well, then I went to work for my parents' bank. His dad owned a bank. Well, the bank ended up losing all this money. They never managed to get it was a huge fraud operation. I don't know who they
went.
Now
I remember.
Yeah, but it was a massive fraud operation, and they never got the money back from his dad or something. I mean, he just went and worked on, there were all these bad loans to like kind of the wrong people, I mean, this is what I remember the thing, and they never got the money back. I mean, the money was just gone. I think the you know FDIC ate the dough or something. So then that was his job. He played bad. So I'm thinking, and now he just is he's always running. Even when he was out of a spot, if he showed up at a party, he always had like a bodyguard and he's shaking hands. The guy's been running forever. Even if he didn't, it's like you know, if Andrew walked in, you had a guy behind him. He's shaking hands and he'd say, "What the hell? What's that guy running for?" Nothing. I mean, but he's been running since he got out of the bank for something. I mean, not saying he's a bad guy. He might be a great mayor, but it's just a weird resume.
Could be running from the law.
Yeah.
Well, it's fame is its own immunity and calling card, and we in the public shouldn't put up with that. You know, we should be looking, as I think a lot of candidates this cycle have demonstrated service to the community in jobs that people respect. You know, medical doctors or you know, military service or something, not glad handing on your father's money, you know. So I don't know much about the guy. Maybe my comment was derivative of what you.
Well, Andrew, I tell you what. What I will say on top of it, without it sound made it sound like I don't. Since he's been Secretary of State, they've made amazing advancements in you getting your license, how easy it is, and stuff. I mean, I don't know if he's doing it or somebody is, but I had talk about a stupid story. I bought this truck from this guy, right? It was a dealer, and I get the title and I send it in and I don't get anything. And all of a sudden, I wait 3 hours on the phone. Well, it turns out the truck came from Iowa. Was that an auction? Who the hell knows? Bottom line is, there was a subsequent title to the one this guy gave me. And of course, they're not going to issue me a new title. Now I'm going, now what do I do? So the lady at the Secretary of State's office gave me the number of the Secretary of State Police, which I didn't even know there was such a thing. And I get this guy, and he goes, "Oh yeah, you know, I'll take it." The guy for 4 or 5 months, he worked his ass off. He got me a new title. I mean, I couldn't believe that there was a police guy that actually gave a crap, and he worked real hard, and he called me up. He said, "I'll make it happen," and he did, because he goes, "I know it's a legitimate sale, but evidently, maybe more than you need to know, if you lose your title for your truck, say you know whatever your dog ate the title or something like that, and you go apply for a new one, you don't get a duplicate of the old one. You get a new one. I don't know if you knew that or not. So if somehow or another you found the old one, and when you sold your truck," gave somebody the old one thinking it was a duplicate, it's not. All of a sudden, that car with the engine number is going to show that it's untitled. I don't know if you knew that or not. But if you get a new title, it's a new one. It's not a duplicate of your old one. I don't think many people... I didn't know that, but I found out the wrong way. But anyway, the guy was there. Everything that department is supposed to do since he's been running there, they've done better than before. So I have no idea if he just hired the right people or what he did, but I'm not saying he did a bad job at all.
Well, let me make an educated guess, being immersed around the bureaucracy here. It's staff work, it's in part, a significant part, if the leader really demands great staff work, and that should be a given. Is there a culture of service that permeates the organization? And that is very important, as you point out, but it should be a requirement for the leader.
Well,
from what I'm hearing with the...
But it's not enough.
The midterms, where the Republicans, especially in the House, may find themselves rolled over by a blue wave, is in the area of constituent services. And a lot of town halls, one of the biggest complaints about the Republicans in the House, especially, is that they don't have town halls because they don't want to face their voters. But where there are at least more in the way of election appearances, one of the common complaints from Republican constituents is on constituent services. They don't answer the phone. They don't respond to letters, you know, and the list goes on and on. And I think this is going to this is really going to bite them very hard in the midterms, because even when I thought about running for Congress from Northern Virginia, it was impressed on me by the guy who was off going to give me some campaign money and all this advice. He said, you've got to make sure that you hit home on constituent services. Even if somebody contacts their congressman about a pothole, well, that's not a federal issue. You got to go through the hoops to satisfy that constituent.
We got to dash off the break here, guys. We come back. I'd like to delve into a little bit. I want to talk, obviously, about the market a little bit and the interest rates, and why I'm keep wondering now with this new, what, now that the Secretary of the Treasury is involved in what stuff the Fed used to use, it adds another variable to what I do, which I really don't need another variable, but that is going to add one. S&P futures up 16 now, NASDAQ futures up 19. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks,
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, and welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Andrew on the board on a Thursday. S&P futures up 18. NASDAQ futures up 39. Part of this breaking news here is we got the interest rates down a little bit. Is Fed Walter says he's going to vote for keeping states steady at the next meeting because I think everything points to a rise. And yet, Trump will have a conniption if they do raise them. But I think that everything points to that. So anyway, that's where that all is. So we've used that little bit of a rally based on that announcement now. I don't know if Andrew and Wayne traded ahead of that. They probably bought some spoos while they were on the show. I don't know. I don't know if they're sneaky enough to do that. I think probably not. Nikkei down 111.2%. Hang Seng down 97.4%. Shanghai up 70 cents. Let's call that one flat. So not much going on over there. We got the holiday week. We got the labor numbers tomorrow, which is the only thing now that people are waiting for. Yet we'll, unless we get more Fed speak, which is can be market moving, and I don't know if those guys even know that or trade ahead of it or what. Anyway. Europe DAX down 13 cents. They're on holiday. We call that flat. FTSE up 55.5%. CAC round down 32.4. So let's stay even across the board over there. Interest rates actually down a little bit. So the 10-year is 4.77. It just about made 5, which is 4.8 the other day. But it hasn't come down much. So it's higher now than when Bessent did his first buy the long. Okay, so in the 30-year is 5.24. It used to be if that got over 5, people worried about it. Now it's 5.5, so it keeps going up. Oil, up $1.09. We're back way up over, at 92.10. So that's not going up. So I'm going to, RBOB's 310, so figure on paying somewhere between 380 and 430, depending on your tax situation, or $5 if you're in the city. That's always good. Gold up $78, 44.92. Gold advances on softer U.S. dollar bond yields ahead of payrolls report. Silver up 85 cents, 1.3%. Foreign exchange, we have the the big one, the Japanese yen, there must have been some intervention here. The yen is down to 155. Yen rallied sharply and markets raised bet on Bank of Japan rate hikes. Wow, let's go back to the bonds. Bank of Japan is they're pushing 3% here. Now these guys, their debt per citizen is like double ours. So for those guys to be paying 3%, they're gagging. They're gagging big time. We'll get Andrew and Wayne's thought on that. Crypto, up $1,000, 78,220. A lot of stuff there, Andrew. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Sport, Cubs lose.
Yes, they do. It is 7:35 here in Chicago, Thursday, September 3rd. Yet the Cubs lost to the Brewers, ending their game at 5-9. White Sox also lost to the Astros, ending their game at 0-2. And the Diamondbacks actually did win this one against the Phillies 1-0. For Chicago weather, it's not looking much better. It is currently 85 degrees. It's going to be very hot this morning. We do have another heat warning in place. It's going to be humid with a little bit of cloud, a little bit of sun. In the afternoon, some thunderstorms are going to be rolling in. We're going to have a high of 92. Oh, and specifically, a possible chance of hail can accompany any downpour. So, yeah, going to be a great one today. Over in Phoenix, a little bit more simple. They're currently at 103, but they also have a slight chance of a thunderstorm and a little bit of clouds throughout the afternoon. They're going to have a high, or excuse me, they're currently at 87. They have a high of 103. And finally, for Chicago traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 33 minutes. Inbound Eden from Lake Coast is going to take you 52 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolfe is going to take you 51. Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 33. And the Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 41 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Andrew, did you have a chance to listen yesterday to when the other Andrew, our producer Andrew, was talking about how he uses AI for his marketing stuff? I found that very enlightening, didn't you? If you were listening.
I did. I was able to listen, and I thought it was enlightening. And also that, I thought he was pretty candid about, the upsides and downsides. And I'll just leave it at that.
He asked me, how did I do? I said, you did fine. I wanted to get somebody else's opinion. Yeah, I think he did a nice job.
Yeah, I think it's one praiseworthy for him to come on the show and you to invite a young person, a young career professional, to add that perspective. And maybe I'm imagining something, but I'll just keep the discussion going. Float a concept. It may be tougher for a young professional to be on a show like this than for older people because, take Wayne, for example, or me. We don't need to worry that the boss is going to come in and say, I heard what you were saying on the radio show. Report to my office and human relations.
Well, we have several guests that I really liked that when they got jobs couldn't come out anymore.
Yeah, I mean that's a factor. And in fact, I was talking a little bit about my friend Tom Condon from Notre Dame earlier in the show, who wrote this great book with his wife, Legal Lunacy. Well, he wrote another book. Which is kind of funny and maybe appropriate. He learned a great title, or he came up with it, Fire Me and I'll Sue. But being a good, well-trained person at Notre Dame and elsewhere, he decided to do a marketing study to see who would actually buy the book, Fire Me and I'll Sue. And he found that the intended audience, people who were in danger of losing their jobs, either didn't have the money or were too stupid to buy a book how to protect themselves.
Remember when we were younger, the guy who was the head of Avis wrote the book Up the Organization when they got bought by somebody? Remember
yeah,
that?
I remember that.
Hey, it's a good thing you're not in Chicago anymore. You'd have been pretty miffed coming from the University of Chicago downtown yesterday because some kind of cruise ship had to come in the river, and they opened up the DuSable Bridge, DuSable Lakeshore Drive Bridge, and because it's been so friggin' hot here for 4 days, When I went to put the thing back down, it wouldn't go down. So the thing was, I don't know if they ever fixed it, but it was like all day the thing couldn't go down. It was a mess. Hey, I got a question for you.
What a mess. Hey, but I got to give the punchline to my anecdote. Oh. So the guy writes a book, Fireman Alsu. He does a quiet marketing study to see who's going to buy it. And he, as I was saying, he realized the intended audience of, you know, the ordinary common worker is not going to buy it. So here's what he did. He oriented the marketing to human relations departments, and he tripled the price because he figured he didn't want to give up the title, but he figured people in human relations departments could buy the book and just put it on the expense account, not as a personal thing. So he added a chapter, basically, or two, how to fire people, with the thought that they're not price sensitive because, you know, the company is paying for it. So he did very well on the book, keeping the original title, but reorienting it to employers who wanted to fire people instead of the schmoes who were likely to get fired.
Well, I have two questions. One is just in terms of general knowledge. I was out with some people. By the way, if you guys are ever around sometime on a Wednesday night, the people I meet on Wednesday, they're older attorneys and a couple judges. Andrew, you would drop right in. It was like you were in a whole old home week, right? But the legitimate questions they had last night, you know, everybody always asks me some stuff. What is with this interest rate in the Fed? Are they going to do it? I said, you know, guys, there's a long series of thought that, you know, the Fed just follows the market. I mean, we've been in the last several years with the idea of buying up the long-term stuff and ballooning a balance sheet from $2 trillion to $7 trillion in 18 months. You can run over the trader like me because you got, like, way more dough. But in general, interest rates are the supply and demand for money. And you have to add an inflationary expectation onto that. And if everybody's convinced that the inflation is going to be 6%, and I'm not saying that everybody's convinced of that, that the Fed can do whatever they damn well please at their next meeting, but they don't control long-term rates unless they're willing to go out and buy every time somebody tries to sell a bond, they buy it from them and jam it up their behind, which they did for, you know, two, three years. But that's not really a long-term game from any government, even though it seems like it is. So you have to be careful when you talk about that they control this stuff. But I want to get back to a question regarding when we're doing a lot of talking today and have for a while on what are people's perspectives on what the hell they're doing, like mayor and whatever. And maybe this is directed more toward Wayne. What does a person who votes for a representative, what do they think they're actually voting for? And I asked this question for a reason. When I was on the board of the SIBO, we used to have these breakfasts when the guys come by. And one morning we had Tom Foley. And I was very impressed with Tom Foley. I mean, not that, you know, that's just me. He seemed very articulate. Anytime somebody asked him a question, he knew he had a serious background of knowledge on the answer. I mean, he sounded like, God, this guy knows his crap. And a big, tall, impressive-looking guy, and not that that means anything. And all of a sudden, I see that the guy gets voted out in his Washington state. And I'm going, I don't know what he did, if he let up a stink bomb in the church or whatever. But I said, the fact is, do the people who voted him out have any idea that they're never going to get a speaker from their district in 58 lifetimes, for God's sake? I mean, how could you replace him with whoever it was? It's going to be on the end of the bench.
The guy that beat him was a guy named George Nethercutt, the Republican, and he ran on the promise of term limits. He was going to term limit himself. Of course, he violated that. It was after he was in there for, like, I don't know, six years or maybe 8 years, he says, yeah, I'm running again.
Well, my question is, but a regular schmuck, like I put myself in that group, if I go vote, I mean, seeing what I'm seeing, mainly because of you guys, that everybody walks into the house, I hear this from Carl because he helped a guy get in there, you're just a flunky from the party once you get there. for in most people's cases. You just vote like they tell you to vote. What do people think they're voting for when they're, if it's a new person? I'm not saying don't put in a new person. I might want a new person, but don't they realize they're the end of the bench? What do they think that person can actually do for them?
Yeah, I think it depends on the district. Like here in Florida, I live in an area, retirees, a lot of them veterans, and usually the Republican gets in by, yeah, I'm for veterans, I'm for, you know, all these bromides that they issue forth. But this year is different because people who are veterans know that the VA budget has been cut thanks to people like Elon Musk and others, and Social Security coming under attack, and Medicare and Medicaid. I think the Republicans, in at least this part of Florida, are in for a rude shock come the midterms, because people who I thought were dyed-in-the-wool Trumpers will never change. They're changing, much to the chagrin of these Republicans. A lot of the incumbent Republicans, for that reason, have decided not to run again.
Well, so, but what is people's perception? I mean, my guy is Mike Quigley. And, you know, I knew Mike years ago because he ran with, running the same time as John's wife was running for judge. So I got to meet the guy a few times. He seems like a nice enough dude, doesn't seem like a crook or anything like that. And and somehow or another in Congress, he ended up being on a couple of the committees that are the double secret ones you have to you're supposed to report, like, you know, covert action and stuff too. So he must be well.
Oh, he's on intelligence. He's on
So he must be pretty well liked and well respected by his peers, which is something I kind of look at. So I figure whatever he's doing, he's doing something right. I mean, but I really don't know what he does all day. I mean, how does anybody know? But he seems like he's okay. But other than that, how does anybody even know what the hell the guy's doing?
Well, again, this is constituent services. They should be letting their constituents know
I get a weekly letter from him, so I mean, he does that, yeah. But I mean, I guess how can the guy you vote for turn the tide? I mean, on anything. I mean, unless you're a Republican that goes against Trump, and all of a sudden you can be national news that way, if three or four Republicans vote against him, or if the Democrats get, you know, a five-person majority and six of them decide to go the other way, they're going to get national news. But other than that, how do you separate yourself?
Well, that is the question for these members of Congress, is they don't have much clout. Or even the senators necessarily, and some of us have seen, you know, examples of that. We can illustrate the point, but that is the issue. Whereas someone like Thomas Massie, who I've gotten to know a little bit, he's a Republican from Kentucky who's really taken the lead on releasing the Epstein files.
Well, he's after the corruption part, right?
Yeah, and because I had a couple of brief meetings and conversations with the guy, I took an interest in his backstory of how he got to where he's a leader. And so he's an MIT graduate, libertarian, big Second Amendment enthusiasts. He opposed his family at Christmas, all with automatic weapons, even the little kids a couple of years ago. But his wife put a bee in his bonnet about a year and a half ago about the Epstein files, and he really didn't know much about it, but things just exploded around him, and whatever background and sense of service he had, he just became a dog that wouldn't let that bone go.
But he's after the, for you know, I because of you two guys, I've got this massive split here between in my own brain regarding the messing around and you know, debasing women and even young boys. That part's horrible. But I somehow or another, you guys have got me. I won't say more interested, but at least is interested in the money laundering shenanigans side that seems to be multi-generational.
And espionage with foreign governments to undermine the United States.
Blackmail.
But it seems to me he's, from what I'm, you know, I hear him in bits and pieces, but he's focused on the women and stuff side. He's not going where Wayne's going, is he, or is he?
Well, I think you're right, but here's what he did, which shows how people can stand out and how they pay the cost. So members of Congress can, under their complicated rules, can get a minute to address the chamber.
That's what he did in his YouTube I watched.
Yeah, and so he only gets a minute, and the Republican leadership doesn't want anybody talking about anything except just passing a continuing resolution so they don't have to face voters with no budget. But he got his minute, as you saw on YouTube, and he named 14 people who were Epstein associates, and most of them were financiers. A couple of them were beauty contest.
Well, the guy from Ohio, Waxman, was one of them.
It's noteworthy he did not mention the the big guy himself, Trump. He did not.
But who was the guy? I mean, I don't want to blab a name out there; that would be the wrong one. But he named somebody from Illinois. Was it a Pritzker or Rickett?
Tom Pritzker.
Who's he?
He's the cousin, isn't he, of your governor?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
He's not that close. It's a different branch of the family. But he was revealed to be a very, very nefarious, trying to arrange assignations using coded phrase. And so you actually had to have the disclosure of the actual text so that you could see that he, I forget what euphemism he was using, you know, like, I want to find some good hockey sticks when I come to.
But he's focused on, I think, for my minute, that's what I'm asking you guys, he's focused on the horrible crap that happened to the girls. He's not talking about what Wayne's talking about, where Bessent is.
Yeah. And as Andy said, that comes from his wife putting.
I don't blame her. Yeah, do you? Oh, hell no.
And David Copperfield, a magician, was on the list. Now, why he was there, I don't. Maybe Epstein was trying to make Copperfield make this whole scandal disappear.
But let me point out what happened to Massey. Is and actually we've talked about it before, but it's all of these things are worth repeating to get the picture, is that Trump actively recruited a candidate to run against him in Kentucky, where Massey was pretty popular, and he lost his primary. So he's on his way out. So he paid the ultimate price for his willingness to go to bat for not only the female victims, but if one digs into this, there were male victims, and then there's the whole world of looting and spying on behalf of foreign governments trying to undermine the United States, and that's at the top of the pinnacle, and the trafficking in girls is just one of the tools.
So Massey's out.
That they were using.
Massey's out.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, he's out.
Well, not yet. He's got
6 months to do this stuff. Yeah. But this is one of the ways that any of these members of Congress, if they wanted to, could have and could still do things, but they don't want to do things. Because they don't want to have pay the penalty, not just from Trump, but from other nefarious people who say, you tried to speak up for your country and underage rape victims, they're not going to say that.
Andrew,
but take steps to get rid of him.
You know my feelings of the man in the Oval Office, but I will say that nobody has a more knowledge of the history of this. Before he even showed up, when have we ever driven something to ground and found the people actually responsible and did something to them? And I'll start with the Kennedy assassination, for God's sake, but Iran-Contra, I mean, you name it, the first Iraq war, all kinds of stuff that could have been, you know, that were massive scandals, and all of a sudden, you know, even the Reagan's crap with cutting the deal with Iran to not, you know, to not negotiate with Carter before he, I mean, it never,
oh, yeah,
this stuff, even Watergate.
Well, let me say something that I haven't said before on the show. We just got a couple of minutes, so maybe I'll just float it.
Oh, go ahead. Fire away.
Interested. It happens that through a succession of leaders and deaths of researchers in the JFK assassination, earlier this year, I was elected to be head of one of the major organizations in the United States researching the JFK assassination. It's called Citizens Against Political Assassination, and we have a conference call that I'm leading later this afternoon. And it was co-founded, I was one of the co-founders, but the main leader was Dr. Cyril Wecht, a very distinguished medical school professor, consultant, and attorney who died 2 years ago, based in Pennsylvania. He's a great man. But he was the original person opposing, in an official capacity, the Warren Commission report. He said it was flawed. Now, with that preamble, I'll just kind of get to the point, is anybody who wants to know basically what happened with the Kennedy assassination can find out. But you're not going to find out by reading major newspapers or watching major television networks or major books, because how could they admit that it would hurt their brand name to say, oh, by the way, here are some of the anomalies in the Warren report that we never told you about. So I'll just leave it at that. But
I just found a clip, and I sent it to Andy last night, of Tip O'Neill, who was a pretty level-headed guy, and he's expressing doubt about a number of shots fired in Dealey Plaza. And he said Kenny O'Donnell and some other Kennedy guy, I forget who his name, but
David Powers. Said,
he said, you know, the FBI came to us and said, no, you heard an echo. There was only one shot. And they went.
And they said, we don't want to get into this. Now, I'm going to actually bring that up. That clip that Wayne sent me on our research call today, and here's what I'm going to say. I'll preview it for your audience. I'm going to say, look, if this tape is authentic, and there's always with AI a question about that, but if Tip O'Neill from Boston says that two of the top JFK aides told him that they intentionally lied to the Warren Commission because the family didn't want to get into things and so forth. Why do we need to keep writing more books and doing more things? I think we've got the answer as close as we're going to get, and the rest of this is spinning wheels. If this Tip O'Neill tape is accurate, because, you know, we're not going to have a criminal trial of anybody. Everybody's dead. But we kind of know what happened if this tape is accurate.
Well, last question, and maybe we'll kick it up bigger next Thursday. there's always a judgment in this. And when I say that, I'm not saying it's a good judgment, but there's, when I was on the board of the SIBO, if somebody, you know, some of the bigger firms sometimes would be, you know, really no good nicks. They'd do something on a trade where, you know, they essentially, you know, I use the term misbehave, to where the client might, it didn't happen, very rarely happen with the members, but sometimes the firms who think that they can do whatever they want, they would do something on a trade where maybe they would juice the price, say a quarter of a buck on a 100 lot. Well, guess what? That's, you know, $2,500. So that's a real number. And since, especially since the felony is like 100, right? And you always get to the point where the CBOE always had the ultimate power, even though they never thought they did. I mean, you weren't going to see, you know, Morgan Stanley suspended from trade in a CBOE for a week. I mean, you never really want to get there, for what it says about the industry, what it says about all kinds of stuff, because people like to believe that what you see every day is straight. I mean, you really don't want to hear about your best milk producer with rodent hairs in the milk. I mean, at some point, you try and get them out of there, but you don't necessarily want to publish. And people make these judgments, and whether you and I agree with them or not, but I mean, guess right now, even if you were to find, I mean, and you're right, the people are dead. What if you were to find that Lyndon Johnson and George Bush Sr. had their eyes totally up the ass of the assassination and were involved up to the teeth? Would you recommend, if you find that, to lob that one on every citizen and going for 70 years, or 60 years, we've been lying to you, and these two people that came on to be president were behind the whole thing? What does that do? Is that a plus or a minus?
Well, I would. Wayne would.
I know. So would I.
We don't. We're not protecting the brand name of the New York Times that wrote stories about the Warren report when their main writer hadn't even read it when he wrote the stories. It was 26 volumes, and they, along with other major news organizations, adopted the view then and still. Let's put this behind us and look forward.
Well, I'm saying, but these are, I think you got to roll with me in the sense that they are judgmental questions by somebody. Now the somebody, what's their motivation? Then you got to start digging through there too, right? But I mean, do you really want to turn the entire apple cart out that your government, your by the way, I'm with you guys. I'm just talking for radio here. I mean, do you really want to do that? I mean, if you were to find out that, you know, Cantor Fitzgerald and Morgan Stanley and were up Epstein's ass because they couldn't wait to send money to Russia when they weren't supposed to send money, I'm not accused. If you did that, do you do more damage that everybody in the FBI and the SEC and everybody for 40 years has been asleep going after anybody but you? I mean, there's a real message there that maybe it's pretty awful, actually, right?
Yeah, I think it sends a message that, you know, we're not going to tolerate people hiding in the shadows on this stuff. I think it's a net plus. And that's why South Africa had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission post-apartheid. They said, look, we're not going to prosecute any of these apartheid officials unless it was murder. But, you know, we're going to shine a light on the crimes that they committed. I think we may need something like that with the Trump administration.
You know I'm on your side. All I'm saying is if you get a whole bunch of what I think regular people that actually care about the place in a room, not everybody would agree with us. They would say you're going to do more damage than, you know.
Of course.
And in some cases, they may be right. You know, I don't know. I mean, does the whole Bush family need to know that every time somebody goes somewhere that the old man killed? I'm not saying he did, but if he did, does anybody, do they really need to, that on the front page of every paper? I mean, what are you saying about them? I mean, it's not an easy question is all I'm saying.
Just the front pages of our websites.
Oh, God. What are you guys doing for the weekend? And by the way, our weather here is worse than it is in Washington. Andrew, you can move back here now if you like it like that.
Ours are like yours in Chicago down here.
We're 95, and you get up in the morning, it's 85, for God's sake.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, it's another couple of days. What are you guys doing for the weekend, anything?
We enjoy our work, so it's pretty boring to most people. But last quick thing, I was looking. I was in the dentist chair, and they had this travel log of somebody running tours of Tampa and St. Petersburg, which is down where Wayne lives. And I'm looking at the thing, just amazed that people pay money to have tour guides of Tampa when they could go down and hang out with Wayne, and they're sitting on the beach with an umbrella over them. And I'm thinking, and people think my life is boring because I'm working, and this is how people spend their vacation.
I would have thought this had been a week where you'd fleet upstate New York, where it's nice and cool. Anyway, guys, thank you very much. Andrew, thank you for covering for Jimmy today. SP Futures up 21, NASDAQ Futures up 30. We got the labor numbers tomorrow, so that's kind of our big information show. Guys, I'll tell you this. Nothing is more confusing to a guy like me than the markets where the bad news is good news and good news is bad news. And now we're at the point where if labor looks terrible, it's okay because we're going to pour more money in the market and the market's going to go up. I think that ship is reaching port somewhere, but I don't know if it's there yet. What do you guys think? I mean, it's this idea that every time something gets worse, we pour more money and the market goes up. I don't know about that. Next week we'll talk about that too. What do you guys, I mean, quick one-word answer, what do you think about that? It's weird.
We're in strange times.
Yes, we are. Guys, you take care.
And you've got a tough job, but I'm sure doing it better than people can expect because it's unpredictable.
If you like to be perfect, Andrew, if you like to be perfect for your clients, it's a tough time. Perfection is elusive, shall we say. You know you're doing a pretty good job, but you're sitting there going, why didn't I see that last piece of news coming? I could have done even better. It's like, you know, I think the three of us have one thing horribly in common, and we're kind of perfectionists at what we do, and it's hard to be. It's hard to be. Anyway, guys, take care of yourself. Andrew, nice job. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.